From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In Florida, accused Fort Lauderdale airport shooter Esteban Santiago was in court today. The 26-year-old Iraq War veteran is charged with shooting to death five and wounding six people at Fort Lauderdale International Airport on Friday, the same day he flew one way from Anchorage, Alaska to Florida, checking only his gun. But in November, Santiago walked into the FBI office in Anchorage complaining of hearing voices and having terrorist thoughts. At that time, police took his gun away. So how did he get that gun back a month later, in December? Megan Omatz is an investigative reporter for the South Florida Sun-Sentinel. Megan, Anchorage police took Santiago's gun from his car when he was at the FBI, correct?
Yes, they did. They took it from him and they held it for about a month. During that time, the police took him to a hospital for a mental health evaluation where we understand he stayed for only a few days and, according to the family, left without any kind of medication or follow-up appointments. As far as we know, he was not adjudicated or committed to a mental health hospital by a judge, and that usually happens after a brief stay in a hospital, as much as 72 hours. To hold someone longer, you need to go before a judge. And we do not believe that happened. If he had gone before a judge, then there would have been a record and more of a case to withhold his a gun from him.
Well, here's where it gets tricky, because there are different laws state to state. We'll talk about that. But under the Federal Gun Control Act, this is the federal law. There's a difference between voluntarily walking in and complaining of voices or ISIS and being involuntarily committed, as you say, adjudicated by a court. We're understanding that because he voluntarily walked in, there is no federal gun law that would cover his having a gun withheld from him.
No, that's right. Exactly. That this is a loophole, if you will, and it doesn't make much common sense if, a doctor and all believes that you are sick and should not have a gun, then, you should be able, there should be a mechanism to withhold that from you. And our sheriff here in Broward County is calling for that kind of reform.
But so far, from the reporting that we know, all of this was voluntary. You know, he brought himself in, whether or not police then escorted him to the hospital. He brought himself in. But there's also another place in the story where people are looking closely. He had a history of domestic disturbances and other arrests, but no convictions. And without a conviction, police also in Anchorage were not able to keep him from getting a gun.
Exactly. And I understand that in Alaska, the state does not have laws prohibiting gun ownership, that they rely on federal laws. If he had a restraining order in which the court said you can't own a gun, that would be one thing. But here, there was no conviction on his record for domestic violence. The police had been to his home. He was arrested at some point for criminal mischief, but that was not a domestic violence charge, as far as we can tell, and it did not result in a conviction.
There are other.
So it does, again, not make common sense. There can be all this activity in his background, and yet he's still able to not only have a gun, but get it returned to him.
There are other places where people are looking to maybe fortify, including that he bought a one-way ticket from Alaska to Fort Lauderdale and had no baggage, practically no carry-on, just one checked gun. It is legal to check a gun, but people are wondering why alarms didn't go off that is all he had, a checked gun going from Alaska to Florida. But meanwhile, Puerto Rico Senator Nelson Cruz told you that he blames the fact that there was not enough health care for this veteran in Puerto Rico. He actually left Puerto Rico to try to get mental health care?
That's what the senator says, who is very close with the family. And as far as we understand it, they have one VA hospital there, and that there can be long waits for help and just difficulty in accessing care, including mental health care. Now, was that the sole reason he went to Alaska? I don't think so. I doubt that. We've heard that he had a brother or a cousin or someone in Alaska, which would make sense. But certainly it sounds like he was having trouble accessing care there in Puerto Rico and wanted to come to the continental U.S.
Yeah. Well, back to the original question, how could somebody, walk into an FBI office and complain of hearing voices from ISIS and then a month later get their gun back? Well, again, it was because they were volunteering this information and volunteering to go for mental health care. Maryland has also expanded their law so that voluntary commitment means you cannot have a gun. Do you expect this to be a bigger debate?
Yes, I certainly do. Our Congresswoman, Debbie Wasserman Schultz, is expected to bring this issue up in Washington, and so is our sheriff. He's very concerned about mentally ill people having access to guns. I'm sure we're going to hear a lot more of this in the coming weeks.
Megan O'Matz, investigative reporter for the South Florida Sun-Sentinel. Megan, thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, a lot going on in Washington this week, and we're going to be keeping an eye on it. A number of President-elect Trump's cabinet nominees facing hearings. President Obama delivers his farewell address, and Trump holds his first press conference since July. Now, Congress is already working to fulfill one of Trump's campaign promises, the repeal of Obamacare. But what else could the Trump administration get done quickly, say in its first 100 days? And does history offer any guide? Joining us now is Julian Zelizer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton's Woodrow Wilson School. Julian, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
And beyond the repeal of Obamacare, and it's clear that there are a lot of questions about what might replace it, what else do you think Donald Trump will focus on quickly?
Well, obviously, I think he might start to threaten some of the overseas agreements that President Obama entered into, including the Iran nuclear deal, and he could start without doing anything, just raising concerns about it and making arguments that Iran is violating some of the terms of the agreement. A second thing which will be very important, I imagine, are tax cuts. This is what Republicans tend to start with, and I think he will be on board with some kind of tax cut package early on.
And how important is it that he have success early on, that he gets things like this done right at the beginning of his presidency?
Well, it's important. All presidents are limited. They have a much shorter window than they imagine when they're campaigning. And the closer you get to the midterms, which are just 2 years away, the more skittish many members of both parties will become about doing anything controversial. So you have to use your time well. And right now is the shock and awe moment when, you know, many people in Congress are still somewhat overwhelmed by his success and he has a little space to govern.
Let's go back and look at some of what other presidents have done right away, right after they took office. Here is a famous moment of transition.
Day one of Ronald Reagan's presidency and day one of freedom for 52 Americans. Though thousands of miles apart, these two historic events moved almost on parallel tracks today. The new president had not been in office an hour when the former hostages became free men and women again.
So that was January 20th, 1981. The Americans held hostage in Iran for more than 400 days were freed as Jimmy Carter was leaving the White House and Ronald Reagan was being sworn in. Reagan gets credit for their release. Is that fair?
Not really. President Carter had negotiated the deal, and it was held up at the very end because they didn't want to give him credit for the release in Iran. So it's not really Ronald Reagan's doing. That said, if you were watching the television, watching the inaugural procession, President Reagan looked like a hero, and he got credit for that, even though he wasn't really the person who worked this out.
What else was he able to do right away as he started his first term in office?
Some of what he does is he uses executive power to move quickly on things. For example, he pushes through deregulating energy markets, oil markets, and that was a very important issue for him during the 1970s, and he doesn't need Congress to do that. He also launches and starts the process of pushing for one of the biggest tax cuts of post-World War II American history. So he also starts to get to work on his bigger agenda as well.
What about Lyndon Johnson, who made unprecedented progress right away on civil rights when he took office?
Yeah, there's barely a second from the moment that he takes office to the time that he starts working on legislation. He's less interested in executive power. He is very committed to trying to move forward the civil rights bill that Kennedy had finally proposed toward the end of his presidency. He's working Congress. He's trying to make sure this bill gets to the Senate. He's also pushing for a tax cut, tax cut that will help working and middle-class Americans right from day one. So he is another example of a president who allows his energy to move him from the very start of the term to work on big bills.
It seems like I'm sensing a theme here that presidents like to pass tax cuts as soon as they take office.
They do. They're two very different kinds of tax cuts, but that is true of both Johnson and Reagan.
What do you think we'll remember about what President Obama did in his first 100 days?
Well, he was focused primarily on the economy, and I think we will remember him, and some people won't remember him fondly, but he was very aggressive both with financial markets and the economic stimulus in trying to create a period of normalcy after really a horrendous crisis that the nation had gone through during the election. And I think when all is said and done, that will be the focus. Healthcare will come, but I think it's what he did for the economy at that moment that was most defining, most important. He also moved away from torture, for example, in our counterterrorism program, which we don't talk about, but was important.
That's Julian Zelizer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton's Woodrow Wilson School. Julian, thanks as always.
Thanks for having me.
And here we are, 9 days into the new year, a lot of people trying to keep to that resolution to lose weight, which brings us to a new book by biochemist Sylvia Tara. It's called The Secret Life of Fat, The Science Behind the Body's Least Understood Organ, and What It Means for You. Sylvia Tara joins us from KUCI in Irvine, California. Welcome.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
And one of the things that I want to talk about is the fact that fat was not always hated the way that it is now. We always think of fat as a bad thing, but going back into history, it wasn't that way.
No, that's right. In fact, there was a time in U.S. history where fat was actually quite loved and valued. After the Civil War, there was poverty and there was destruction, and food was hard to come by. And those who had fat were considered privileged and beautiful, and people tried to look like they had fat. And it wasn't until, you know, later, till the economy got a little bit better, food was more available, people started gaining weight again. And that's where there were some warnings from military, from business, from politicians about the nation's growing girth.
Why? What was it that changed that made people all of a sudden fear fat?
I think just that, you know, it used to be only the select few could afford to have it. Then all of a sudden, when everyone's getting it, people just got a little bit, you know, wary of that, that it's now catching on with everybody. And, you know, created a little bit of an echo chamber, this worry about fat. I mean, even doctors previously had thought fat was not so bad. And they actually, you know, advised fat for helping with contagious disease, helping with nervousness. And that it all just changed when it got to be where a lot of people could have it. And, you know, what happened then is another voice in the chorus against fat would happen to be businesses, entrepreneurs, hucksters who saw this great way to sell all kinds of gimmicks to people who were afraid of fat now. And odd things came in, the tapeworm diet, where people would ingest tapeworm eggs so that the tapeworms would siphon off calories, fat off, reducing soap that was supposed to melt fat under the skin. There's all kinds of ways to make money. And the advertising of these products became another really strong voice in the chorus against fat, to the point now where we have multi, you know, billion-dollar corporations going at this. We spend $60 billion or more on the fight against fat, more than we spend on the war on terror. And I think if we're going to spend this much money on fat, you know, we're going to target weapons against it, we have to really understand this enemy that we're fighting. And fat is much more than just a reserve of calories. It's actually quite sophisticated.
Well, and one of the things that you talk about is the fact that we need fat to propagate life.
Yes. Fat is actually an endocrine organ. It produces a number of hormones in our body that our body needs. You know, one of these really important is leptin. And leptin has vast effects within our body. I mean, fat is tied to brain size, to brain health. It's tied to strong bones. It's tied to our reproduction system and conception even. And so when people lose too much weight, women particularly lose too much weight, they actually can't reproduce. So, you know, fat is vital to life. And because fat is so important, nature tries to protect it. And, you know, through leptin again, one of the effects is leptin has a very, you know, strong direct link to appetite. So when we have a good amount of leptin, we feel pretty satiated and our metabolism's pretty strong. But when we lose fat, because fat produces leptin, we lose leptin too. And with lower leptin, our appetites, you know, shoot through the roof, our metabolism gets lower, and in that way, fat fights, our bodies fight to keep fat on us, to get it back.
And what about exercise? Because as you point out in this book, some of what determines your body composition and the amount of fat you have has to do with genetics, but a lot of people are able to exercise and try to counteract some of that.
Yeah, and exercising in itself releases certain hormones that counteract, you know, where your fat is and how much you have. So some of the hormones that you can use against your fat, you know, growth hormone is one, and that's something that ebbs as we age. Testosterone's another great fat burner, you know, also that ebbs as we age. Adiponectin is another hormone fat makes that actually affects fat distribution. So adiponectin is fat's own way of clearing fats out of the blood and directing them into fat deposits where they belong. In this way, it's like fat is telling the fat in our blood to please come home, please come to these fat deposits. And the good thing about adiponectin is that it's really associated with less visceral fat, the fat under the stomach wall, which is more dangerous, and it tends to deposit fat in the subcutaneous layer, that layer right under the skin that is healthier fat to have. So exercise does help distribute your fat into healthier depots, and it does also affect where your fat is in that way. It's not so much under the stomach wall, it's more in that more healthy subcutaneous layer.
As you look at the research, why is it that some people are able to eat as much as they want and they never gain a pound, and other people have to be very careful and exercise a lot and they still have trouble losing weight?
You know, a number of things. One, if you've yo-yo dieted, you've had this effect to where you have, you know, you now have lost some weight and your leptin is lower and you have a lower metabolism and you're hungry all the time. So that right there is one reason you'll have to eat less going forward. 22% fewer calories less than someone who's at that weight to begin with. And there are other factors that play in, too. You know, certainly genetics has a role here. There are certain genes that actually predispose people to higher appetite. They need more self-control. There's some genes that just create more fat cells. That's going to be another reason some people have more fat. The bacteria we have in our gut has a role here. Some bacteria extract more calories out of our food than other bacteria. And some people have a microbiome that tilts toward more calorie extraction. And so say you're eating a bowl of Cheerios, you know, it might say 100 calories on the label, but in fact, depending on your microbiome, you might be getting 80 calories out of it. You might be getting 100 calories out of it.
We're speaking with Sylvia Tara, whose book is called The Secret Life of Fat, The Science Behind the Body's Least Understood Organ and What It Means for You. And Sylvia Tara, let me ask you about Randy, who you profile in this book, who got scratched by a chicken when he was little. And after that, and because of that, began to gain weight.
Yeah, that's a really fascinating story. So it turns out there are viruses in our environment that are linked with fat. And it's been known about in animal studies for quite some time. Canine distemper virus causes fat in mice. Rouse-associated virus causes fat in chickens. And until, you know, fairly recently, it wasn't really observed with humans. But I tell the story of Nikhil Durander, who actually identified a virus that is linked to obesity in humans, too, and that is AD36. People who have had the virus, when they test positive for ever having the virus, they actually have a 3- to 4-fold greater risk of having obesity. And Randy was one of the people I wrote about who was positive for this virus. And, you know, he got scratched. He thinks it's because of the chicken that he had in his farm. After he had gotten scratched by this chicken, he noticed his appetite greatly increased, and he started putting on fat in huge amounts, more than ever before. And he struggled with this, really, for decades, you know, getting north of 300 pounds. And it wasn't until he crossed paths with Nikhil Durander and Richard Atkinson at University of Wisconsin that he learned about such a virus. Once he identified the causes of his fat, just that knowledge, and knowledge is power here, he was able to really, you know, understand it, do the things he needed to do, increase the exercise, realize that he just can't eat as much as other people because he creates fat more readily. And I think part of what I'm hoping to do with this book is just help people identify, take away some of the fat shaming, the guilt around fat. It's not just sloth and gluttony. There's a number of ways we get fat. There are genetics, there are viruses, there are bacteria. You know, gender plays a role, and our hormones play a role. And you have to consider all of these things when you're trying to lose weight. You might not be eating more than your neighbor, but you might have more fat. And don't feel guilty. It's not because you're failing at your diet. It's because you have to understand your fat.
Well, what have you done? Because you've had your own struggle with weight.
That's right. Even as a child, I gained weight pretty readily. And, you know, through my teen years and my 20s, I had a real struggle to keep it down. And I tried a bunch of different diets. And sometimes I'd lose some weight. I'd lose it temporarily. It would come back. And there were times I even gained weight on some of these diets. And I finally just got really fed up with this. And I'm a scientist by training. And I thought, you know, I'm going to really understand fat. Before I go on one more diet, I have to know everything there is to know about fat. And so that's what I did. And that's the basis, really, for The Secret Life of Fat. And I know I went on a number of diets that didn't work for me. And I think now that I have this knowledge and I'm empowered, I can tailor diets that work for me. And I have finally honed in on one that seems to keep the weight off.
Well, one of the things that you've tried is intermittent fasting, which other people have tried as well. How does that work, and has it worked for you?
It works well. And one of the reasons intermittent fasting works, which is really just fasting for about a 14, 16, you know, 18-hour period, and one of the reasons it's thought to work is that it extends the release of growth hormone overnight. So our growth hormone, which is a fat burner, peaks at night. And if you can extend your fast either in the morning or the night before, you actually the thought is you extend the release of growth hormone, which helps bust through fat. And so what I've learned to do is I eat, you know, light breakfast maybe at 9, 10. I'll eat a lunch and a snack at 3, and I'll fast. I'll just have a very long fast overnight. And what I love about that method is I can almost eat whatever I want during the day. As long as I do that fast, it doesn't stay on me. It is not easy to do. It's not for everybody. You could also, you know, fast during the day and eat dinner if dinner is an important part of your life. But something to consider if you've just found you have extremely stubborn fat the way I do.
What's the one thing that you feel really guilty about eating but you do anyway?
Oh, chocolate. No doubt. But you know what I've learned? So I keep a log. This is how I honed in on what I have to do. And what I've noticed is that some things cause me to gain weight and some things don't. Some things that don't are supposed to cause me to gain weight. And amazingly enough, chocolate was one of these things. Mm. It doesn't make me gain weight. As long as I don't eat it, you know, right before bed, I can get away with it.
Lucky you. Sylvia Tara, her book is called The Secret Life of Fat, The Science Behind the Body's Least Understood Organ and What It Means for You. Thanks so much for joining us.
It was terrific to be here. Thank you.
This podcast and the following message are sponsored by Blue Apron. Blue Apron is the fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service you've heard about. Its mission is to make incredible home cooking accessible to all. They support a more sustainable food system, set the highest standards for ingredients, and make it easy and fun to cook. You decide which recipes and how many meals you want each week, change, pause, or cancel anytime. Learn more at blueapron.com/here. Go now and get your first 3 meals free, plus free shipping at blueapron.com/here.
More than half of the states in the U.S. now have legalized medical marijuana. Another 8 also allow the use of recreational marijuana. So if marijuana is okay for people, does it follow that it's also okay for pets? Veterinarians are increasingly being asked about treating pets with cannabis. And as Tom Bonsi of Here and Now contributor to the Northwest News Network reports, that can put the doctors in an awkward spot legally.
You go. Jessica, girl.
Hello.
Hi there.
Who's this?
This is Willie, and he is a 16-year-old Lhasa Shih Tzu.
Michelle Batten of Portland, Oregon, owns the small caramel-colored dog. She says Willie has a variety of age-related problems, including arthritis and anxiety from vision loss. Prescription painkillers made him sluggish.
So we started on the cannabinoid capsules.
Cannabidiol, better known as CBD, is derived in this case from hemp, the variety of the cannabis plant that's not mind-altering.
I was very open to it and so pleased with what I saw. Just, he's so much more content. He sleeps better. He's not in pain. And he doesn't have the anxiety.
Does it seem like the pets are getting high?
No, not at all. Just more calm.
Batten takes Willie to a clinic that advertises holistic pet care. Dr. Cornelia Wagner runs the Hawthorne Veterinary Clinic. She says pet owners turn to hemp or medical marijuana for many of the same things humans take it for these days, including cancer symptoms, pain, inflammation, seizures, nausea, chronic skin allergies, and loss of appetite.
5 years ago when I started here, hemp never came up. Or cannabis hardly ever came up, but now we talk about it a lot.
Dr. Wagner tells dog owners that their animals are much more sensitive than humans to the effects of marijuana. Her clinic only stocks a few over-the-counter, non-psychoactive hemp-based supplements, like the pills Willie the dog swallows twice a day.
The Cannapet products, we have them in capsule form, and they come in different strengths.
Hemp for pets is largely unrestricted right now. Marijuana is different.
Legally, we have to be careful about it, even though recreational marijuana use is legal in Oregon now. As veterinarians, we are not allowed to prescribe it. So we have to be careful about giving recommendations.
The U.S. Food and Drug Administration on its website cautions against usage of marijuana products for pets. The FDA says the safety and effectiveness of these products has not been established and needs further study. The murky legal terrain got murkier last month when the Drug Enforcement Administration said it considers all extracts from the cannabis plant to be controlled substances, including from hemp. Olympia, Washington vet Dr. Lisa Parshley says she's hesitant about cannabis products, not just for legal reasons, but for the scientific unknowns.
I just feel like everybody's trying to jump the gun and get into the use of this without doing due process in the research lab, in the clinics, and try to get a really good product out there that's safe and actually works.
But entrepreneurs in pot-friendly Western states aren't waiting for the smoke to clear to meet consumer demand. Startups are selling a range of cannabis products for pets, from capsules, oils, butters, and tinctures to infused chew toys and dog treats. For Here and Now, I'm Tom Bonsi.
There are more than 3 million teachers in the U.S. Most are white women. In fact, black men account for just 2% of the country's teachers, leaving many black boys who have far lower graduation rates than white boys or girls without mirror image role models. Well, in Philadelphia, Sharif Almeki is behind a push to change that. First, he hopes to organize a group of 1,000 black men to welcome kids as they come to school next year. This is done in other cities. Kids walk a gauntlet of cheering black men who encourage them while breaking down stereotypes. But Sharif also wants to double the number of black men teaching inside the schools by the year 2025. Sharif Almeki is the principal at Mastery Charter School Shoemaker in West Philadelphia. So Sharif, Principal Almeki, this all starts with a group you and other teachers founded just to meet up, the Fellowship. What is that?
So the Fellowship is a group of black male educators who are committed to social justice. So our full name is the Fellowship Black Male Educators for Social Justice. We look at schools and classrooms as ground zero to righting many of the social ills that plague our communities and nation. And what we would like to do is just increase the diversity within our district. Right now, about 4.5% of our Philadelphia's classroom teachers are black men. And a significant number of students go through school without ever experiencing a highly effective black male educator. And we want to change that. And so we used our partners in the school district and charter world to come up with basically three pillars in how we were going to try to address this. So we have three ways that we're doing this. One, we're continuing the black male educators convenings because what we found in our research, even when cities and districts increase their black men, as educators, they are not able to retain them. So we wanted to have convenings to offer professional development and make sure that folks felt supported. The second pillar, we want to advocate. So we want to talk to universities, policymakers, current and aspiring educators. And then the third piece was really to influence the pipeline. We know that we cannot do it from a traditional lens. Last year, only 28 black men graduated from Pennsylvania's teacher colleges. So that's 28 for the entire state. None of the 17 founders of the Fellowship considered teaching when we were in middle and high school.
I found that incredible that something happened after that. I mean, in other words, you didn't set out to be, you wanted to be a lawyer.
Exactly, exactly. I knew I wanted to deal with social justice issues, but I thought it was through the courtrooms. And it wasn't until after I had graduated college that someone said, you know what, I really see you as a teacher. Have you ever considered that? And then I went back to school to do that.
Well, there was another incident, we understand. We'll pick up how your group is working. But you were shot during a pickup football game in Southwest Philadelphia?
Yes, yes. Bartram High School, Southwest Philadelphia, right off of Willen Avenue. I have a football game on a Sunday. We had been playing there for quite some time. Some other guys showed up and wanted to play. And one was upset that I tackled him too hard. And what I did not realize was that he had friends in the stands with guns. And they came over and handed him a gun. And Told him to shoot me, and if he didn't, they would. So fortunately, I survived that, and which also influenced my road to the classroom because I ended up working at the Youth Study Center, which is a center for children waiting to be adjudicated.
Well, you know, because you had this empathy, it sounds like, for your shooter, that, you know, you recognized that he had trouble with anger management, someone who was oppressed and oppressing others. It's
right,
pretty
right.
I mean, given that you've got a gunshot wound, how did you come to that? How did you come to see that?
Well, I think a lot of it was my upbringing, and both my parents they met in the Black Panther Party, and I guess our upbringing was always around figuring out how to address social justice issues through empowering communities. So even going through that traumatic experience, I was still able to understand that this young man would likely has gone through some trauma of his own. And I even met his mother and his child. And I understood, like, wow, here's another young man, and this may continue a cycle where the father is going to jail and this son is growing up fatherless. And what is that cycle? How can I get involved and not just say, hey, I was a victim and that's that? How do I make sure that my heart doesn't become hardened because of that? And I thought the Youth Study Center was the best route at that time, which and for children who got into some kind of legal trouble.
So that's your own sort of entree to this. Now you have, as we said, this fellowship, other teachers who have joined together to try to put teachers in schools so that they inspire younger people to maybe think about being teachers. It could be self-replicating that way. But you talked about how you all get together and talk about the specific problems that you have. What specific problems do Black male teachers have?
So I think one of them is just being the lone person in your school. So if you're in a school with 50 teachers and you're the sole Black male, you know, your voice may not be heard.
Or worse, I was going to say, your voice may be the one that's constantly called upon to explain Black culture.
That was the next piece, exactly. And your frustrations, you may have to elevate your voice, and then you're seen like, well, that's just an angry Black guy, so, you know, disregard that, you know. So there are a lot of different things. And what we also found from our research and the surveys were Black men felt pigeonholed, that because they had really good relationships with some students who may struggle, that people looked at them as the person to mentor for the building. And so they mm-hmm. become this father figure for many students, some who they didn't teach directly. But they found themselves feeling that pull and divide of how to navigate that space.
So you want to have more fellow Black male educators, start them younger, let them be role models for young people, but also share the teaching of not just the young Blacks, but other students who everybody can benefit from diversity. But what do you say to people who say, look, it's not that there are not enough Black male teachers. That's not the real problem. It's that there are problems of poverty and bias and inequity, poor school funding. Christopher Emden of Columbia University wrote about this. He said, educators, Black or white, are not well enough trained to address these larger issues and biases. And, you know, I'm thinking that it might almost be a setup for Black male teachers. You can't fix all these problems.
Yeah, I read that. And a lot of what Professor Christopher wrote, I agree with. What I don't agree with is that we don't resolve issues. Like, there's very few times when there's a silver bullet that solves everything. What's within our locus of control is to help, for me as a Black male educator, to support other current and aspiring Black male educators. I can't wait until poverty is resolved. I can't wait until housing is addressed. What I can do is make sure that the students in front of me, Black, white, or Hispanic, whatever, have a windows and mirror. Right now, Black children in particular, they only see windows. They see it in society. They see it in media. They see everyone else's lives projected. And so we have to be careful of what novels we put in front of them, that there's a balance. We have to make sure that what teachers we put in front of them is a balance. On the flip side, white students in particular, they don't have windows, they have mirrors. They constantly reinforce their positive racial identity. It's constantly reinforced in different ways. And what they don't see is a diversity in those that manage situations or those are in charge and authority. They don't see a diversity in that. And so that window and mirrors philosophy is very important to our work. And we believe firmly that having a more diverse teaching force is a huge part of addressing some of the issues that we have in our schools and classrooms.
Hmm. How are you feeling it's going? I mean, you've got this 2025 goal. It's pretty early on, but are you seeing young people thinking this might be a field they want to go in? What are you seeing?
Yeah, so right from the very beginning, one of our first commitments that we made was that we would have direct conversations with our own students about becoming teachers. Before that, we had not done that formally, a lot of us as educators, and so we just made a commitment, one, to do that. We're having every day, folks are emailing us at the fellowship and asking about whether, hey, I'm a career changer, I'd like to engage in that, or I'm an educator, I would like additional support, I want to stick around and be here for the long term for my students. And we're having universities are reaching out. So we believe we're making a big impact, and it's still very early on.
That's Sharif Elmeki, principal of Mastery Charter School Shoemaker in Philadelphia. We'll check back in with you. I'd love to see how this goes. Thank you.
Thank you for having me. Have a great one.
The Detroit Auto Show kicked off today amid pressure on the auto industry from President-elect Donald Trump, who wants automakers to do more manufacturing in the U.S. Over the weekend, Fiat Chrysler announced it would invest $1 billion in already existing plants in Michigan and Ohio. Today, Trump tweeted, "Thank you." Derek Thompson is senior editor at The Atlantic. He joins us from New York. Hi, Derek.
Hey, Jeremy.
And this announcement from Fiat Chrysler comes after Ford last week canceled plans for a new factory in Mexico. It does seem like the pressure from Trump is working, is it?
It's interesting because I think the message from these CEOs is simultaneously, hey, Donald Trump, look at us. We're being good and not offshoring work. And at the same time, they're sometimes explicitly also saying this has nothing to do with Donald Trump, or this is very little to do with Donald Trump. I believe that Ford CEO Mark Fields told NPR that Trump was, I think, quote, a factor in right. the decision. But there were lots of other factors, like there is a lot less demand for small cars in the U.S. market. The same is totally true for Fiat Chrysler. They have been expanding pickup and SUV production at their Ohio and Michigan plants. And this is a continuation of those ongoing plans. So I think a macro point here with implications for the next 4 years of news coverage is that Donald Trump is an extremely significant force in politics, in economics, but he is rarely the only force. And here in auto manufacturing, you're seeing what's happening is demand for automobiles is shifting back toward larger crossovers and trucks and away from small cars. And that inherently benefits domestic U.S. production with or without a Donald Trump as president.
And not every company here in the U.S. is bowing to the pressure from Donald Trump. General Motors CEO Mary Barra said yesterday that the company will not change where it produces cars based on criticism from the president-elect. What do you think Mary Barra is doing here?
It's interesting because all of these messages are both information and marketing, right? A message from a CEO is rarely simply trying to communicate the underlying truth. It's also a bit of marketing and performance. And so I think these companies are not only trying to explain to investors the future of their investments in the U.S. versus Mexico, but also trying to communicate to consumers, perhaps in this particular case, in Barra's case, we're not going to kowtow to Donald Trump. So if you are a future car buyer who doesn't like the president-elect, know that we are the company that has explicitly said we are not going to bow to his pressure. So I think there might be a little bit of that going on as well.
But if companies like the ones we talked about do end up investing more in the U.S., if these automakers start making more cars in the United States, what does that really mean for consumers, for the economy? Does it do all of the things that Trump has said or is hoping that it will do for this country?
Yeah, I think we have to be careful here about being overly certain about the near future of U.S. job creation, particularly in industries that are being beset by automation. On the one hand, what do Americans want? They want more and better jobs. And there are several forces that crosscut against the growth of U.S. employment. One is globalization, moving jobs and production overseas. But another is automation. And sometimes you can fix the globalization problem without fixing the automation problem. So So, for example, Carrier, the manufacturer of air conditioning and other products, famously announced that they were going to keep production in the U.S. with some state tax credits from Vice President-elect Mike Pence, but then also suggested that some of the jobs that were saved, that they were not going to ship to Mexico, they were actually going to replace with automation. So it is not enough to simply have a couple of front page announcements from, you know, one or two even large cap companies saying that they're not going to move one factory to China or Mexico. These forces of globalization and technology are more powerful and more ongoing than one day's news cycle.
The other thing is, if you start making more cars in the United States where labor costs are higher, do those costs get passed on to consumers? Are cars that we buy going to be more expensive?
Yeah, and this is the deal with globalization. This is the trade-off. Globalization creates global competition for work, which can put a downward pressure on wages and the availability of that work. That's not good for workers, particularly those concentrated in areas that are vulnerable to offshoring to China or Mexico. But when you keep those workers here and those workers are paid more, then yes, of course, one possible downside for consumers is that the product is going to be more expensive because you have all of these labor inputs that cost more. So, you know, globalization is like everything else in economics. You have this trade-off, and the trade-offs can be agonizing and, as we've seen rather recently, sometimes politically consequential as well.
So, Derek, we've just got about a week and a half left until Trump takes over. Do you expect more of this kind of going after individual companies trying to get what he wants even after he becomes president?
I think this has to empower Trump to say, wow, I can change the future of corporate policy with a few tweets, number one. Number two, I also think that there's a bit of what psychologists might call social influence or better known as peer pressure effect among CEOs. CEOs don't know 100% for sure when it is best to hire or not hire, offshore or not offshore.
Right.
And so to a certain extent, it's possible that they're sort of following each other. And so when one makes a decision to keep production here, another one makes the same decision.
Same thing.
It'll be fascinating to watch.
Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic. Thanks as always.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.